Yeah, that's perfectly fine with me. Thanks, Bill, and good afternoon, everyone. And thanks for providing me with the opportunity to present the Basel Committee's implementation monitoring work in this meeting format that has become the new normal for all of us. So my understanding is that you have the slides in front of you. So starting with my slide number two, before elaborating on how the Basel Committee monitors and reports on the adoption of its standards, just let me say a few words about why, after Basel III, implementation is so important for us, and therefore why implementation has been a key part of the committee's work over the past few years. I'm conscious that this question may, the answer to this question may be may appear obvious, since any standards will have no impact if it's not actually implemented. But the response is, to some extent, a little bit deeper than this in at least two ways. First, implementation is a key element of any policy-making cycle. Only by implementing standards in a consistent and full manner can we reap the full benefits of the standards, understand and assess their impact, and draw any takeaway for future policy making. And from that perspective, monitoring implementation helps to avoid both complacency and backsliding. Second, safeguarding financial stability is for sure a matter of global collective responsibility. And the benefits to global financial stability of Basel III can only be realized if these Basel standards are implemented across jurisdiction in a full, timely, and consistent manner. And also that brings clarity and certainty of regulations, as well as a level playing field. And I think that the current situation illustrates pretty well how it has been so important to ensure that the regulatory reforms adopted after the financial crisis, including Basel III, be implemented. The rules put in place following the crisis have ensured that banks are now more resilient, have more capital and liquidity, and therefore are much better prepared to deal with the shocks to the economy, like the one resulted from the pandemic. And that's exactly why G20 leaders have consistently repeated that full, timely, and consistent implementation of reforms are key. And more recently, that's why they warned that policy responses to the pandemic should not roll back regulatory reforms or compromise the underlying policy objectives of the existing standards. Having said that, let's move to the how. I mean, the Basel Committee launched its regulatory consistency assessment program a few years ago, 2012, and this program has three objectives. First, monitors the timely adoption of our standards, so as to assess if jurisdictions have adopted the standards on a timely basis following the agreed deadlines. Second objective conducts peer reviews on the completeness and consistency of our standards adopted by our members, so as to assess whether or not their national domestic rules are compliant with our standards. And third objective assesses the outcomes of the application of the standards, notably on the capital and liquidity position of banks. And I will focus today on the two first aspects, monitors timely adoption and assessing the consistency, since evaluation has become, I would say, part of our evaluation program. So moving to my slide number three, I will start with timeliness. The Basel Committee produces semi-annual monitoring reports to the G20 leaders on the implementation status of various Basel III standards. These reports are mainly based on self-reporting by our members. They provide a high-level overview of committee members' progress in adopting all our standards. And we publish these reports so as to provide an incentive for our members to adopt the committee standards in a timely manner. That's very detailed. This report, as I've said, are public. So, and we plan to publish our next one in June. Initially, we expected to publish in March or April, but of course, following the pandemic, we had to revise the schedule. So next one will be available in June. And from that evaluation of the timeliness of the adoption of our standards, the global picture is that overall, our members have made very good progress in implementing our standards. For example, all our members have risk-based capital rules, liquidity rules, and capital conservation buffers in force. Many members have made also many progress in adopting more recent Basel III standards, like the one on large exposure framework, or the one on interest rate risk in the banking book. So the global picture is that most members have the key standards already in place, but for a few of them, with respect to other, I would say, most of the time more technical standards, they have yet to put the standards into effect. Moving to the consistency, and it's my slide four. In addition to periodically reporting to the G20 on the status of adoption of our standards, all our members undergo an assessment of the completeness and consistency of their domestic rule with our standards. And it's in the committee's charter that they should do that. What are these jurisdictional assessments? This consists of peer reviews. These are led by committee members, and they involve experts from our members that assess the extent to which the domestic regulation are aligned with the minimum Basel standards. So it's a deep dive into domestic regulation. The idea is to go line by line and to see if there is any deviation from the framework. And when there is a deviation, we try, whenever possible, to quantify the importance of this or the materiality of these deviations. We publish all our assessment reports, and these reports include an overall compliance grade with the framework. We have four grades. The regulation could be compliant, largely compliant, materially non-compliant, or not compliant. And this grade provides good incentives for members to take any corrective actions to address the deviations identified in the assessments. And in addition to that, we also regulatory publish what we call follow-up reports to track the corrective actions taken by members after the publication of the assessment reports. So to date, we have published assessment reports for all our members' jurisdictions regarding their implementation of the risk-based capital framework, the liquidity coverage ratio, and the JSIPS framework. And in 2018, we started to review the implementation of the net stable funding ratio and the large exposure framework. And afterwards, we'll comment on the review of our final Basel III standards. I will not elaborate a lot on the next slides. It's slide five and the following. They provide you with some details about the outcomes of our assessments. Slide five shows that from a consistency perspective, you can see that for most of the standards, most, if not all, jurisdictions have been assessed as either compliant or largely compliant with our standards. And what's interesting, if you look at slides 6, 7, 8, and 9, which provide detail on the outcomes of our assessment of the four standards I've mentioned, capital, liquidity, LCR, NSFR, and large exposure. It's just for your background information, but I wanted here to illustrate how effective is this monitoring, because if you look at the number of findings, you can see that there is a decreasing number of findings over time, and you can see that most, if not all, jurisdictions have taken actions to address, corrective actions to address the finding raised in the report, so as to better align their domestic rules with the framework. And that's exactly the rationale for conducting this peer reviews. Being conscious of the time, I will go to my concluding remarks. There is clearly an imperative. This is the full, timely, and consistent implementation. I've explained why we pay so attention to that. We, as I have said, we can see good progress, but there should be no room for complacency. And I've explained G20 leaders have called for ensuring that there will be no rollback of regulatory reforms following the pandemic. I mean, following the measures taken by members to address financial stability issues raised by the pandemic. And I will finish by just two brief comments. One is about the fact that the focus of our review is on our standards, but we pay also a lot of attention to our guidelines and some practices. And we have some guidelines that are at least, that are as important as standards. For example, we have our principles for effective risk data aggregation and risk reporting, and we pay attention to ensure that banks and supervisors are taking the right steps to improve consistency with these principles. And the second final comment is about evaluation. I've just said a few words on that, but it has become a very important part, and it's complementary to our monitoring work, because one aspect is to monitor the implementation, another one is to assess the impact. And from that perspective, we focus on two aspects. One is to evaluate the impact of the final Basel III framework on banks' resilience. And second, we'll have a look at the behavioral incentives and financial activity implications arising from our reforms. So I shall stop here, and I will be happy to take any questions following the presentations.
Thank you very much, Olivier. I'm going to take a step back, because I got a little ahead of myself at the outset. I should have asked Lee White, the executive director of the foundation, to moderate this panel. So Lee, can I hand it to you, with my apologies for getting ahead of myself?
No need for any apologies at all, Chair. It's great that we've moved on, but members, let me try and just set a little bit more context to our session. Obviously, we've had engagements with the Council in the past around this area, around monitoring adoption, and particularly the word adoption here, because that's where we're really focused on, rather than necessarily the application. One follows the other in a sense, but this session is really around that consistent approach to adoption. I think it's wonderful we've got, you know, organisations of the global standing of IOSCO, the IMF and the Basel Committee here. So what we'll endeavour to do is, I might come back to Olivier with one question now from what he's just presented. We'll then move to other two panellists, and then try and bring some of the common themes out that we're starting to hear. We will take a break in about 45 minutes or so. Everyone can refresh themselves just for about 15 minutes, and then we'll come back for another 15 minutes or so of questions. So that's where we'll go. Olivia, if I could come back to you, thank you very much for that comprehensive presentation, in particular, you know, the outstanding work that the Basel Committee is doing in its monitoring of adoption. Could I come to a particular area that you raised in your presentation, which was publishing the public reports? And so I would welcome your experience about how monitoring was occurring before the publishing, if there was a time, and what impact the publishing did. You used the word of it provides an incentive, and I'd just like to get that insight more around the type of impact that the public reporting had, please.
Yeah, sure. I think I use the terms incentives because, as you know, the Basel Committee has no supranational power, so disclosing sure. is our way of providing such incentives. Looking at the outcomes of the assessment, I've mentioned that most, if not all, jurisdictions have taken corrective actions to address the findings, and most of these actions are taken during the assessment itself. And the objective is simply to get the best grade as possible for them. And in some banking system, that's very important because it provides clarity about the fact that this jurisdiction or this region is consistent with the Basel framework, so that any stakeholder may have confidence on the especially on the resilience of this banking system, the capital and liquidity positions reported by yeah. banks in this system. So, and in some jurisdictions, that's very important, not least, for example, from an investor's perspective. So that's the main incentive for the jurisdiction to take corrective action. And my personal view is that without disclosing the outcomes of the assessment, without including an overall compliance grade with the assessment, this yeah. objective will be very difficult to be met.
Lovely. Thank you. Thank you for that advice and insight. Did it, just one other very quick question and then we'll continue on. Did it slow the process down at the time of the inspection, or if I hear you correctly, in fact, it became much more effective because the types of remediations or solving some of the elements that were being flagged as problems happened quite quickly? I'm just interested in the speed element.
I mean, maybe two aspects there. One is that our methodology, by the way, this methodology is public. It's available on the committee's website, what we call the AIRCAP handbook. Under this methodology, we explicitly allow our members to ask for a delay, typically a 3 months delay, to finalize the assessment so that they could take more time to address findings. Yes. Because, you know, we have different legal or rulemaking processes across our members. Some have a parliamentary process, some jurisdiction have agencies which can take directly corrective measures. So it depends on the jurisdiction. So in a nutshell, they can have extra time during the assessment to take corrective action. And the second aspect I wanted to mention is that, of course, we have a very, it's a very quantitative assessment process, but we have yes. Also a few qualitative assessments to perform just to assess the implementation, for example, of disclosure requirements. It's difficult to quantify the impact of any deviation in this area. So we use some qualitative assessments, and of course, there might be cases where the assessed jurisdiction is not or does not share exactly the views or the outcome of the assessment team.
Yes.
And how to deal with such a situation. So we have, of course, a very detailed exchange of views, but we have also in the reports, up front in the reports, of the report, a response from members' jurisdictions. So the assessed jurisdiction can express some agreement and or disagreement with yes. some outcomes of the assessment. So, and yes. that's important to have this as well.
Thank you. Yes, and that would all then be on the public record. So yep. the reflections or the response. Okay. Thank you very much. That was very valuable insights. May I then come to our next panelist, Josaphat, representing IOSCO. Could you please provide your insights and remarks?
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can. Welcome.
Thank you very much. So first of all, I want to thank all of you for your invitation to share with you some of the experience that IOSCO together with the CPMI have gathered in implementation monitoring process. So I have also shared with you some PowerPoint slides. I'm not going to talk about all of them, but just on a few of them. If you go to slide number 4, you can see as well that the life cycle of a standard involves different stages of evolution, let's say. On the one hand, for the PFMI to be issued, this require coordination, in this case, by two international standard setting bodies, IOSCO and the CPMI. And then let's say that we can refer to two legs for making work and standards. On the first leg, we will concentrate on the drafting of the very standard. And this is a very important thing to keep in mind because the elaboration of the standard sometimes requires negotiation, even of the language of the standards, the particular terminology, or how you phrase the a sentence within a standard. So this is a very complex work. And then we have the other leg, which is really the implementation monitoring. And somehow part of the complexities of the creation of standards are also transmitted to the implementation monitoring, because then you have to agree what is it exactly that you are going to monitor. In the case, for instance, of the PFMIs, are you going to monitor implementation or adoption of the principles, the key considerations, or you will also want to assess the adoption of the guidance? So this is something that we should keep in mind when talking about implementation monitoring. And of course, there is another area which refers to the assessing the intended or unintended consequences of the reform. So in this case, if you go to slide number 6, you can also see that there are many parties involved in the monitoring of the implementation of the PFMIs. So we have on the one hand IOSCO and the CPMI, but also you can see that there are some international financial institutions such as the IMF and the World Bank that are working on this area. As well, you also have the local authorities, either the capital market regulators, the central banks, or even the Minister of Finance. And you also have the very FMIs themselves working on implementation monitoring. So of course, I'm gonna focus on the work of the CPMI IOSCO. In the next slide, slide number 7, you can see that the CPMI and IOSCO have set up a specialized group to take care of the implementation monitoring. This is the implementation monitoring standing group. And this reports to the steering group, and the steering group reports to the parent committees, which are the IOSCO board, and in, on the side of the CPMI, it is the CPMI and also the governors of the Global Economy Meeting. IOSCO and the CPMI agreed to have a comprehensive implementation monitoring framework, also to define the work of the implementation monitoring and also a methodology for conducting the assessment of the implementation, and also a defined timeline, which is, I think, one critical element here. Regarding the jurisdictions to be covered by the implementation monitoring, the CPMI and IOSCO agreed to focus on 28 jurisdictions. You can see these jurisdictions in slide number 9. This is not to say, as I previously mentioned, that other jurisdictions outside these 28 are not being monitoring by how they are implementing the PFMIs. The World Bank and the IMF are conducting some additional reviews, but these are the 28 jurisdictions that are the focus of the IOSCO and CPMI. And as you can see, this covers both advanced and emerging markets. So we have, I think, a very comprehensive selection of countries to monitor the implementation. Now, very quickly, just to talk about our implementation monitoring process, we follow 3 levels of implementation. The level 1 is basically a jurisdiction's self-evaluation or self-reporting on the degree in which they have completed the process of adopting different implementation measures. This is very important to keep in mind, because sometimes the implementation monitoring involves that a jurisdiction authorities simply issue, let's say, a secondary regulation, which is relatively easy. But in other cases, it might involve a jurisdiction's authorities to go to Congress to reform a law. So this is a more complicated topic, depending on the jurisdiction situation. In the level 2, we have peer reviews, again, to review the contents of those implementation measures, basically the completeness and the consistency. We are not focusing on whether the FMIs are complying or observing the PFMIs, or how effective is the work conducted by the authorities. We are just looking at the regulatory framework and other types of implementation measures taken by the authorities. And then we have a level 3 thematic review, which is basically an assessment of the consistency of the outcomes of these implementation measures. So what I try to illustrate here with these 3 images is that on the level 1, you have a car. So a jurisdiction says we have completed the process. In the second level, you really go to see that this car complies with the standards. And in the level 3, you try to assess the consistency in the outcomes. For each of these 3 levels, you can see in the slide number 11, we have different implementation monitorings. For the level 1 and for the level 2, we have some ratings, which indicate, in the case of the level 1, the degree of progress in the process of adopting implementation measures. In the case of the level 2, basically, the ratings reflect the degree of consistency and completeness of the implementation measures against the PFMI. And the level 3 does not involve the use of ratings, but rather we focus on consistency of outcomes and issues of concerns that merit attention by the authorities. In slide number 12, you can see that, we have a very standard process for conducting the implementation monitorings, which involves putting together some assessment teams, the use of some standardized assessment templates to get information from the authorities or FMIs, and also a governance process that involves, as I previously mentioned, the approval by the IMSG, the steering group, and the parent committees. And at the end, we have the publication of the assessment reports. All the reports are publicly available on the IOSCO and CPMI website. You can see in slide number 13, the different level 1, level 2, and level 3 assessment reports that we have published. There is also one combined level 2 and level 3 assessment that was conducted for the review of the responsibilities for authorities. So this talks also that CPMI and IOSCO have a very structured framework, but still we can have some flexibility in order to combine 1 or 2 levels in order to have a specific outcome that we are looking for. So moving on to slide number 14, I would like to refer to some challenges facing the implementation monitoring. One of them is the difference in the approaches for implementation monitorings. And this is due to the different legal systems or traditions that jurisdictions have. Some, for instance, are rules-based approach, others policy-based approach, while others combine the two approaches. So sometimes it is very difficult to say or to conclude whether two different ways to implement a measure, either one being too general, another more granular or specific, are really full and consistent with the standard. In order to address this point, the IMSG has developed a level 2 handbook that helps the assessment team in terms of process and substance for conducting the assessment. We also have developed a level 2 database, which is public, in which you can see the different measures, very specific, very granular, that the different authorities or jurisdictions have put in place in order to implement the PFMIs. One additional important challenge is on interpretation, because sometimes the authorities or the FMIs interpret the text or the content of the PFMIs in different ways, and then this requires the IMSG to discuss whether that particular interpretation is valid or not. And for that, we have set up a particular process to solve the issues. So the assessment team prepares an issues note, which is discussed by the IMSG. And depending on the complexity of the topic, we can also involve another specialized group within the SG framework, which is the policy standing group. And finally, the secretariats keep a repository of the issues note and the related guidance. So in case we encounter a similar issue in another assessment, the assessment team could take a similar approach and be consistent across jurisdictions and across time. Another very important issue is how to address the identified gaps or shortcomings. As Oliver was referring, we are not authorities nor enforcement agencies. So in the case of the implementation monitoring of the PFMIs, we rely on the willingness and ability of our members to make progress. Sometimes, and this also relates to the first leg that I was mentioning at the beginning of the presentation, in the creation of the standard, sometimes authorities have to negotiate the specific terminology or the language to be reflected in the standard. And in this case, there is also an external component. As you can see, probably during after the global crisis, a lot of countries were really committed to move on with the reforms. But after some years after the crisis, the level of engagement is probably not the same. So this is a challenge, probably not only for IOSCO and the CPMI, but also for other standard setting bodies. And finally, one challenge has to do with translation. The standard working language, as you know, is English, but as we are covering other jurisdictions in which English is not the mother tongue, well, it is difficult to get the proper translations or obtain them on time. So a timely translation and preparation of the document is very useful for the work of the assessment team. And finally, I just want to mention some takeaways that deriving from this experience. It is very important that in your work for monitoring the implementation, in this case of the IFRS, you agree on what is exactly what you want to monitor, or either whether you want to focus, let's say, on a level 1, level 2, level 3, or cover all of them. You can also focus on what are the most relevant jurisdictions or topics that you want to address. And you may also want to consider taking regional perspectives. Other jurisdictions may follow by looking at the example of the most relevant jurisdictions implementing the standards. It is also very important that you could enter into a dialogue with the authorities of the different jurisdictions that we want to cover, because they can tell you what are really the gaps or the implementation urgency for this work. It is also very important to have a well-defined program, a timeline. For instance, in our case, all our members, the 28 jurisdictions that we are covering, they know where, in which day, year, they will be assessed for the different level two exercises. Finally, it is very important to ensure consistency in the implementation process, either by having an assessment methodology standardized, a standardized assessment process to pool a group of experts that are familiar not only with the standard, but also with the assessment process, and resolve any interpretation issues by the use of issues notes. Finally, it is very important that you educate your prospective jurisdictions, because sometimes the jurisdictions know the standards, but they are not familiar with implementation monitoring process. So to the extent they understand what is the information that they are expected to provide to the assessors, that will help in order to get better answers and there to support a better assessment. So basically, these are some of the takeaways that I want to share with you, and I will be glad to take any questions after this initial presentation. Thank you.
Lovely. Thank you very much, Josephat. That was a very comprehensive presentation, but and also quite succinctly, particularly through the approach, the reporting, and where my keenness was around the sense of where your challenges are. May I just come to a couple of areas where I'd like to just understand your experiences a little bit better. You spoke about the three levels of assessment, the self-reporting, the peer review, and the assessment of the outcomes. Is it important to have that three layers, is my first question, and do you find at times, as you progress the three layers, that there are differences that arise, that you weren't aware of something in one of the levels, and then something, as you've done further work, something else has come through? So do you find the three levels valuable in confirming what you've already known, but also identifying elements that perhaps you didn't know from an earlier level?
Yes, thank you. On your first question, yes, the three levels of assessment are very useful to the work that we intend to do. This is not to say that others could do differently, but the advantage that I see in having these three levels is that you could monitor and incentivize implementation in different roads, let's say. So in the first level one, you are incentivizing your authorities to implement or to take, adopt measures to implement the PFMIs. And you can say it is very important that you do it, let's say, in this period of time. And then regardless of that progress on implementation, as some of them reach the level of implementation of the measures, then you can assess whether this is complete or not. So the assessment of the implementation at level two does not prevent jurisdiction making progress at the level one. So this is part of the beauty of having three different levels. And this also relates to your second question. When you see on the level one on the level two, how jurisdictions are adopting measures or implementing the PFMI, you can identify some differences, as I mentioned, in interpretation of different ways that probably could provide input to the implementation monitoring work to say, probably in this particular aspect, the standard is not that clear, or we need to issue additional guidance to show jurisdiction what we expect from this particular requirement. And that type of input you can also get from the level three exercises. So the three of them can provide valuable feedback.
Yes, understood. Thank you. Thank you for that explanation. You would have heard from Olivier when he was doing his presentation of the benefit of the public reporting. I sense from your presentation you also see that as an important element of how you see improvements occurring. But I thought I'd better ask the question. You would not see the elements of improvements to the same degree if you didn't have public reporting. Do you see that as a very important part of your processes?
Yes, actually, as I was mentioning, since we have to rely on the willingness and ability of our members to address the gaps, we think that one way to not only incentivize but make transparent the implementation monitoring process is by publishing the assessment reports. And this is supported in two ways. I was mentioning that we have a very clear governance process for the approval of the reports, and this involves also taking the views of the assessed jurisdictions. So by publishing the report, we can also show other jurisdictions, either within these 28 participating jurisdictions or more broadly, because the reports are on the website, what are the key challenges that other jurisdictions are facing. And this way we can incentivize a global implementation. This is not to the purpose of blaming and shaming, it's just to help others better understand the importance of the standards and the implementation process.
Understood. Thank you very much. I might then progress to our next speaker. So thank you again, Josephat. Ellen from the IMF, perhaps if I could ask you to do your presentation, please.
Yes, thank you, Lee. I hope you can all hear me properly.
I was just saying welcome.
Well, thank you, Lee, and good morning, everyone. This is 8:05 a.m. On my side. Thank you very much for inviting me to speak and to have the opportunity to share with all of you the IMF's way of helping our members with quality and consistent implementation of international standards. So I'm just going to start from the second slide, which is the first slide. So we basically approach this on multi-dimensions through broadly 3 to 4 channels. First one is the Financial Sector Assessment Program, FSOPs, and followed by technical assistance and policy papers. And also we work very closely with the international standard setters and institutions. And so one of these is in itself very big. And so I will stay very high level in this presentation to observe our time limit. And so before I get into each one of these in a little bit more detail, I want to emphasize that each one of these items, it informs and reinforces each other, and together they form a positive feedback loop. So for example, FSAPs, among many other things, could recommend technical assistance. And FSAPs and TA experiences together can inform policy discussions and advice. So all of these pieces together, including the close collaboration with standard setters, help the IMF's global membership with quality and consistent standards implementation. So in the next slide, I'll use one slide to provide a little background on FSAPs. So overarchingly, FSAP is a very in-depth and comprehensive examination of the country's financial sectors. And so the financial stability assessment is a key instrument of the IMF's bilateral financial surveillance. And FSOP findings is a key input into the IMF's Article 4 consultations, which is a economic surveillance. And so the financial stability assessment is done broadly in three categories. The first one is the risk and the vulnerabilities assessment, including stress testing, among many other things. And then the financial sector oversight and financial stability policies. Under this one is the standards and code assessment, among many other things. And lastly, the financial sector architecture and safety nets. I'm not going to go into all of these in detail. So in this section, I'm just going to focus on the most relevant one, which is the standards and code assessment. for the financial regulation supervision under the financial sector oversight component. So one point I want to make is that we don't just conduct FSOPs for the 29 jurisdictions with systemically important financial sectors. We also do it for emerging and developing economies at their request. And we actually do a lot of these and jointly with the World Bank. And so this again reflects the IMF's global membership. And so I listed some main FSOP outputs because I'm going to talk more about these in the next slide. And just very briefly, the FSSA is the main report prepared for the IMF's executive board. And it incorporates the findings from the DARS and technical notes. And DARS is the detailed report for standards and codes assessment. So in the next slides, I'm going to focus on the standards and codes assessment. And this assessment in FSOP is actually voluntary, although most members do request this because it's an important and useful one. And so this can be done as part of the FSOP, or it can be a standalone assessment. So the most frequently assessed are the three I listed, the Basel Core Principle on effective supervision, and the IOSCO's Principle for a Securities Market, and the Insurance Core Principles. And so these three codes are actually endorsed by the IMF's executive board, together with some other standards and codes. And so this assessment provides very important input and basis for the overall risk assessment and the targeted FSOP recommendations. And so that in the context of our topic here, so how does the standards assessment contribute to the implementation monitoring and the quality and consistent adoption? So we see the contributions at a few levels. First of all, this is at both the country and system level or cross-country level. So at the country level, we provide an independent external and expert assessment of the compliance with relevant international standards and practices. And so for these three, they are detailed principle by principle assessments for regulation, both regulation and supervision. And at the same time, and this exercise also provides cross-country perspective to allow comparison and experience sharing. So another contribution of this process is on report publication, which helps to provide transparency and in turn, quote unquote, positive peer pressure for quality and consistent implementation. And so the DARS, they include both recommendations and ratings for compliance for all set of three sectors. And this publication is voluntary, however, most countries do publish their DARS, and they publish this even when they don't agree or fully agree with the ratings and the assessments. And there's a place in DARS for the authorities to express their views towards the IMF's ratings and assessments, and this is also published. And so people can see both sides of the story. And so one thing that is worth highlighting here is that the FSB members, they have agreed to lead by example and agreed to publish their DARS, and that's a very positive factor. So next I'll move on to the technical assistance and the policy paper slide. So FSOP, as I said, is a key surveillance tool for the IMF. At the same time, it's also a technical assistance instrument because it provides recommendations. At the same time, FSOP can also recommend specific technical assistance on specific issues and specific standards. And of course, members can also request their own TA. So the point here is that we don't just monitor the implementation and assess the compliance. We also get down to the hands-on level to help members on specific issues and to even implement our own recommendations. And these can include implementing Basel III and so on. So this is a full service, if you will. And so one important thing I want to mention here is applying proportionality for emerging economies and low-income countries. in adapting the international standards. And this ties very closely to the consistent and quality implementation. So our global membership includes many developing economies, and we would like to practice even-handedness in servicing our members. So this is a very relevant and important issue for us and for the members, and a challenging one. So for example, Basel III mainly targets the internationally active banks, and it's quite complex. It's good quality. So to encourage and help our members in the developing economies to move to international standards and practices, and what we do here, we help the members to apply proportionality and adapt, for example, Basel's capital and liquidity framework based on their size, level of complexity, and risk profiles, without compromising or diluting the quality of the standards, or uphold the quality, if you will. So we see this as our value added in helping with the quality and consistent adoption for developing economies. And in fact, we have done a lot of TA in this regard, and based on the valuable FSAP and TA experiences, the colleagues in my division recently published a paper on this very subject to help the developing countries at large on how to apply proportionality in adapting Basel's capital liquidity frameworks and how to sequence them. So this is a very example of integration between FSAP's TA and policy advice. So I'm moving on to the very last slide. Here, the IMF works very closely with many international standard setters and institutions. The list is actually quite long. I can't list everyone here. Obviously, we are a member of the IFRS Advisory Council. So we certainly work with the Basel Committee, the IOSCO, the IAS. We're a member of them and join their meetings. And I want to mention that we also very actively and extensively participate in the FSB's work, including the FSB's standards implementation monitoring work and the evaluation of the effects of the post-crisis regulatory reforms. And so the benefits of this kind of collaboration is both ways. It benefits both the IMF's work and the standard setter body's work. And so with that, I thank all of you for your attention, and I give this back to Lee. Thank you.
Lovely. Thank you very much, Ellen. And again, a very helpful and comprehensive presentation. Clearly, I heard a lot of starting. You can start to sense the consistency amongst the three panelists about how many of the elements of the approach and the reporting is occurring. So I won't ask you again that question, but I think I'll take away from it the value you sense from the public reporting and also giving the opportunity for a response to be made regarding what's been put onto the public record there through the voluntary the processes. Could I come back to this term, because you're the one panelist has used this term so far about proportionality, and I find that very interesting. And I suppose my question here is this a relatively new element to how you have been approaching this work, or is it something that's actually been embedded for some time? And how do you provide a sense of guidance around this? Because I think what I'm hearing when I hear that term is we're endeavouring to tailor the engagement for the emerging economies, or tailor the application, but not compromise the key components. Is that correct? So I'd love to hear just a little bit more of your experiences on that.
Yes. So proportionality is, I mean, given the IMF's global membership, proportionality has always been very important. And this is not just in technical assistance, this is also in FSAPs as well. So in the FSAPs, in the standards and codes assessment, certainly you have the issue of consistency. And so in these FSAPs, we use the international standards. However, you do need to apply judgment. First of all, these methodologies are principle-based, and they are flexible. flexibility is built into it. So the assessors would need to apply judgment and use the concept of materiality and proportionality. So that means it's almost a case-by-case assessment. You need to take into account the country's level of economic development and the level of financial sector development, infrastructure and instruments, and their legal and regulatory supervisory frameworks. These are all very different from country to country. So the point is that you want to uphold the quality of the standards, but tailor this to the specific situations of the country in assessing it. I mean, for example, in the FSOPs, not all countries are in Basel III. Some are still in Basel I. So in this case, you cannot just use the Basel III to assess them. You need to tailor this and adopt this. And so this applies to the assessment for both supervision and regulation. And the proportionality concept definitely applies to technical assistance. As I said, we received, after the Basel III was rolled out, people want to go up to the higher standards. And we received a lot of requests on technical assistance on how do we apply this in my country, the Basel Capital Liquidity Framework. And so that's why we produced the paper. And it's very hard to generalize all of this, but we try to have a overall message for all countries, because each country's case is different. And so I can give you some examples. So some countries are basically, the trading or market risk may not be as pronounced in these countries as in some of the countries. And so the market risk, the standardized market risk framework under Basel is quite complex. And recently in Basel III, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, they have a more simplified version. But even this version is complex, not simple, too complex for some. So some adoption would be needed. And the same thing for the credit risk standardized approach. The prior version can be is a bit more reliant on the credit ratings, and the newer version under Basel III is more risk sensitive. So for countries who are moving, who are still on Basel I, moving from two to three, the decision is: do we move to Basel II? And this approach is about to be faded out in 2023, or do we just move to Basel III with a tailored? So that's the kind of decision we need to make. And so on the publication, if I may say something more about the publication, I know the two speakers have already said a lot about it, but I want to just highlight two things. Yes, this is the incentive for people to draw information and to have a better practice and compliance with the standards. But at the same time, we want to say that this is not a beauty contest. It's not meant to be that. It's really meant to be an information resource. Sometimes people like to compare their ratings. It's inevitable. But this is meant for people to share information, to look at really the qualitative and the narrative assessments and the analysis to draw that experience. Another thing is that the balance between transparency and confidentiality, right, on the publication. Yes, we have the publication with DARS. Most people publish, and that's positive. But at the same time, the IMF staff also follow very strict confidentiality clause in handling the confidential information provided by country authorities. And another report I did not mention in the slide is called the Aid Memoir. And this is a confidential report, and this is not published. And this report is more detailed and longer than the FSSA, the main report. And it incorporates the same findings, inputs from DARS and other reports. So there is a channel for confidential information and alongside the publication and transparency.
Thank you very much. That last element in particular is very helpful around getting the right balance there. So thank you.
Lee,
Olivier speaking. May I just come in to say very few words about proportionality, because as Ellen mentioned, it's a very important topic, and proportionality is embedded in the core principles, and the Basel Committee supports, of course, the use of proportionality in implementing the Basel framework, recognizing that proportionality can take different forms, and Ellen illustrated a few ones. Just two broad forms of proportionality. We said the Basel Committee said that proportionality could reflect implementing the most appropriate approaches available in the Basel framework, either standardized approach or internally modeled approach for banks in members' jurisdiction. And from that perspective, there is no expectation that banks must use internally modeled approach. That's a good example. Another form is that implementing standards for banks in non-Basel Committee member jurisdiction may be challenging. So what's important is to be broadly consistent with the principles of the Basel standards in this jurisdiction. And as you said, Lee, I think what's important is to not compromise the objectives of the reforms, the policy objectives, meaning that the framework, however it is actually implemented, what's important is that this framework does not reduce the resilience of banks or dilute the prudential framework, but as Ellen said, it could reflect differences in risk and complexity across banks and banking systems. So that's it's important. So, and that's, by the way, that's the reason why our member jurisdiction are also free to apply more conservative requirements. So, proportionality is a very important topic, and the Basel Committee pays a lot of attention to that.
Lovely. Thank you, Olivia. That's very helpful. We've got a few minutes left of this session just before we have a modest break. I'd like to come to each of the three panelists, and I'll ask this around in a way about resourcing. And we've heard how some of the activities are occurring and peer reviews, et cetera. But what I'm trying to understand is, within the limited resources of each of your organisations, in a sense, how much of resourcing is dedicated and underlying the priority of the work that we're just talking about here. Now, I'm not after, obviously, you know, it's X number of people and that, but I'm trying to get a sense that this is in my words, is it a very much significantly resourced part that reflects the importance of the priority to the work, or is it fitting there somewhat less than that because people are involved in a range of other activities outside what we're doing? It's a general question, but I'm trying to get to the sense of priority and resourcing, if that makes sense. Olivia, you're on top of my screen here, so I might come to you first on that question. Yes, that's what happens. You focus on whoever's last spoken.
Clearly, assessing consistency is a very resource-intensive work, and it's resource-intensive in our case, for the committee itself, because the committee has to discuss the reports. Typically, the team leaders are committee members. It's also very time-consuming for the secretariat. We have a team dedicated to the implementation and to support the assessments. It's resource-intensive for the assessed jurisdiction, because the starting point is a self-assessment, meaning that they have to map their own regulation with the Basel standards, and it's a significant work. And it's resource-intensive for all of our members, because As I've said, we rely on the expertise of assessors provided by our members to perform the assessment. And just to give you a flavor of how time-consuming our resource-intensive this peer reviews are, typically we have a team or, let's say, between 5 to 7 assessors led by a team leader. And it takes approximately 6 months to complete a consistency assessment. So it gives you just a flavor of the time-consuming nature of the work.
Thank you. That's very helpful. Josephat, could I come to you with your reflections around resourcing, please?
Yes, thank you. This is a very good question, and actually, I have to say that the IOSCO and the CPMI provide assistance to the assessment teams and, in general, to the work of the implementation monitoring through the Secretariat staff. But really, the burden of the work is on the members who need to provide or nominate experts. And then, of course, an important part of the work has to be done by the assess authority or the participating FMIs. Having said that, probably the level one is less resource intensive because since we rely on self-reporting, it is much easier to review the information and check for consistency. However, this is different for the level two and the level three. Even for a level two assessment of the completeness and consistency of the implementation measures, it is different on a case-by-case basis. So let's take, for example, an assessment on payment systems in the European Union. For that, you will need to involve the European Central Bank and other national competent authorities that will have to provide different responses according to the level of the responsibility that they have. Or even if you go, for instance, for CCPs in the US, well, you have not only the Federal Reserve System, you also have the SEC, the CFTC. So the complexity of the assessment is different, and therefore the resources that you need to accomplish that is different in each case.
Understood. Thank you. And Ellen, just some reflections briefly, if you may, around resourcing, please.
Yes. This is a very important topic. Just speaking for the FSOPs, these are massive exercises and very resource intensive. A large FSOP can take 30-something people. A small one is less than 10 people, and it can take up to a year. And dollar-wise, very expensive. So there is, and we definitely receive more demand than our resources allow. So we need to prioritize, and we need to, the point is to balance the resource and quality, right? You don't, given the resource, you want to make sure and not compromise the quality. And the technical assistance also, we do, just give you an idea, just my department, we did 1,000 technical assistance missions last year. That takes a lot of resources and money, but technical assistance is not just funded by the IMF, but also by donors, international donors. So it is slightly better, but still we receive a lot more demand than we can supply. But the bottom line is, so both the FSOP and TA are given very high priority in the IMF's work. Because the three main pillars of the IMF's work is surveillance, under which is IFSOP, and capacity development, which is technical assistance, and the third one is lending. So that these are definitely priority work.
So thank you. I might now pass back to our chair, Bill. Just. I think we're scheduled a couple of minutes over for our break, and then I think we can return after that for questions.
Okay, Lee. Thank you. Thank you very much, Lee, and thank you very much to the panelists. That was really very interesting. Well done. Let us break for 15 minutes. Let's return at, say, 10 minutes to the hour. 10 minutes to the hour, and we'll open up the floor for questions, comments from members. Thanks again.
I was just going to say, Bill, my apologies talking over you. If they wish to use the chat at any point leading up to them, we reopen, it'll help guide our conversation.
Yeah, good point. Good point. Thank you again. See you in 15 minutes, 10 minutes to the hour.
Okay, thank you.